Imagine Thomas Jefferson sitting at a wooden desk in 1776, right? He's drafting the Declaration of Independence. Stakes are literally life and death. Suddenly, his quill just stops.
Right, because of the text message.
Exactly. A digital chime rings out, and he looks up this glowing modern interface floating in the air just to see a passive-aggressive text from Ben Franklin demanding a revision. I mean, it sounds like a completely bizarre fever dream.
It really does, but Google actually just spent millions of dollars to make that exact scenario a reality.
Yeah, they did. Welcome to today's deep dive. We are super thrilled to have you with us as we tear through a stack of sources today that, well, at first glance, they look completely unrelated.
Yeah, we're pulling from the July 5th, 2026 edition of the Tekken Night newsletter. And we've got like video games, Japanese pop stars, federal lawsuits, and crypto infrastructure.
Right. It feels like someone dropped a filing cabinet and just scooped up whatever random papers were on the floor.
It really does. But when you actually read them together, this massive, undeniable narrative starts to emerge.
Yeah, we are basically watching the real-time death of physical ownership and the aggressive rise of a purely synthetic culture. Okay, let's unpack this because we absolutely have to start with that Thomas Jefferson scenario.
Oh, the Google ad.
Yeah, Google dropped a 65-second ad for Gemini AI and Workspace on the 4th of July, and it basically set the internet on fire.
I mean, the tagline alone was designed to provoke a reaction.
Group project, but make it 1776.
Exactly.
It is wildly produced. You have actors in period-accurate colonial garb, but they're interacting with these floating Google Docs.
Right. Jefferson, Franklin, and John Adams jumping on a Google Meet to argue about the draft.
Yeah, and at one point, Jefferson uses Gemini's Help Me Visualize tool to pick a national symbol, and the AI swaps a picture of a lion for a bald eagle.
While Gemini is taking the meeting minutes in the background.
And then the absolute kicker, King George III, literally requests access to the Google Doc, and the AI auto-suggests hitting reject.
It is a highly polished, you know, demonstration of Google Workspace features, but injecting those mundane office tools into such a sacred historical moment, it created an incredible amount of friction online.
People lost their minds over it. Critics were saying it was insulting to reduce the founding fathers risking the gallows to a corporate group project.
Yeah, there were prominent conservative commentators arguing that this was just Silicon Valley being completely tone deaf, like trivializing American values just to sell a monthly software subscription.
Right. And now, just to be completely clear to you listening, we are simply reporting on the contents of the Tekken Night newsletter here.
Right. We are not taking a side on the political critique.
Exactly. But it does raise a major strategic question.
Mm-hmm.
Is a trillion-dollar tech giant really just this clueless about how people view history? Or, you know, is there a deeper game being played?
What's fascinating here is that the controversy isn't a byproduct of the ad. The controversy is the ad.
Right, because of the attention economy.
Exactly. In the modern attention economy, a polite, respectful commercial about software just gets ignored. Having millions of people angrily debating your product on a holiday weekend, that is a massive win for their organic reach.
Yeah, that makes sense.
But if we dig a layer deeper, look at the psychological framing they're attempting with Gemini.
You mean how they're positioning the AI in the room?
Yeah, think about the dominant public anxiety right now.
That AI is going to replace us.
Right. People are terrified that artificial intelligence is going to replace human creativity, human writing, and human jobs.
Okay, I see where you're going.
Notice what Gemini is not doing in this commercial. It is not writing the Declaration of Independence.
Thomas Jefferson is still the author.
Exactly. Gemini is relegated to a secretary. It takes notes, it formats, it manages access.
So they are desperately trying to brand AI as an assistant, not an author.
Yes. By inserting it into 1776, Google is subtly arguing that AI is just a natural evolution of our basic tools. The subtext is basically, if the founding fathers had this, they would have used it to get things done faster. And you should too.
Wow.
It is a massive psychological campaign to soothe public fear and normalize the technology for everyday tasks.
It's a really clever branding pivot. I mean, Google is spending millions to convince us that AI is just this harmless, glorified intern taking notes. But if we look at our next source, Hollywood is currently in federal court arguing the exact opposite.
Yeah, the entertainment industry's view of synthetic generation is entirely adversarial right now.
Here's where it gets really interesting. On July 3rd, the AI image generation company Midjourney dropped a legal bombshell in their ongoing battle with Disney, NBC Universal, and Warner Bros. discovery.
Right. The studios are suing Midjourney, claiming they illegally scraped copyrighted movies and characters to train their AI.
And we've seen that lawsuit 100 times. But Midjourney just filed a formal discovery request demanding that these massive studios reveal their own internal AI secrets.
And we're not talking about superficial emails here. Midjourney wants the studio's internal business plans, their research data sets, and crucially, the model weights of any machine learning systems the studios are developing in-house.
Okay, let me stop you there, because the newsletter mentions model weights, but I really need a translation. What actually is a model weight, and why is Midjourney demanding to see Hollywood's?
Think of an AI's training data like a massive library containing millions of books and paintings. The AI reads all of it.
Okay, got it.
The model weights aren't the books themselves. They are the mathematical connections the AI's brain forms after reading them.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, it's the underlying logic of how to paint like a Disney animator or how to light a scene like a Warner Bros. Cinematographer.
Hmm.
The model weights are the actual intelligence of the system.
Right.
And they are proprietary, heavily guarded trade secrets worth billions.
So Midjourney is demanding the secret sauce. But what is their legal strategy here? Are they just trying to embarrass the studios with a you do it too defense?
Yeah.
Like, you can't sue us for stealing if you have a basement full of scraped data yourselves.
It is much more lethal than just embarrassment. Back in June, a judge ruled that the studios only needed to provide discovery on their public-facing, consumer-level AI.
Right. The studios want to keep this trial focused purely on what Midjourney did to them.
Exactly. If they maintain that narrow focus, the studios have a very strong copyright claim. Midjourney's demand is designed to pry open the black box of Hollywood's internal secret R&D.
But couldn't Disney's lawyers just say, listen, whatever we do internally is just experimental. We aren't selling it to the public, so it has no bearing on Midjourney selling a commercial product.
They will certainly argue that. But the legal concept of fair use and AI training is completely unsettled law right now. If discovery forces Hollywood to reveal that they're routinely scraping the internet, including works owned by independent artists or even rival studios to train their internal storyboarding or visual effects models, it completely undermines their core legal argument.
Because their argument is that scraping is inherently illegal.
Yes.
And if scraping is theft, then Hollywood is guilty of theft on a massive scale.
The trap is set perfectly. If the judge grants Midjourney's request, the studios might be forced to settle simply to protect their trade secrets.
Oh, wow.
But if it actually goes to trial, it could establish an industry-wide precedent. It will either legitimize using copyrighted material for AI training across the board, or it will build a massive legal wall that both scratty startups and century-old studios have to obey.
It is wild to watch Hollywood fight tooth and nail to lock synthetic art in a courtroom. Because over in the music industry, they aren't just letting synthetic art out of the box. They are literally putting it on stage as the lead singer.
Yeah, the contrast is really striking. While film and television see synthetic creation as an existential threat, the music business is actively funding it and engineering it for a global audience.
Yeah, at the Anime Expo in LA, there was a massive announcement for an EP coming in fall 2026. It's called Beyond Borders Vol. 1 Emerge Mode Miku.
Quite a title.
Right. And the lead singer is Hatsune Miku, the, you know, eternally 16-year-old virtual pop star voiced by Saki Fujita using Yamaha software.
Right.
But she is collaborating with major Western hyperpop and alternative artists like Grimes, Slayer, Odatari, and Frost Children.
Yeah, this is a big deal.
Now, I'm looking at these stats in the Tech at Night newsletter. It says the Vocaloid music market generated over $680 million in 2025.
It's massive.
It is a staggering amount of money.
Mm.
But it also notes that 75% of that revenue was localized strictly in Japan.
Mm-hmm.
So how do you take a niche, localized software phenomenon and suddenly force it to collaborate with Western artists? Like trying to make an indie instrument the lead singer of a global pop supergroup.
You have to look at the government backing here. This project is supported by Japan's Agency for Cultural Affairs under their Cool Japan policy.
Okay, so it's state-sponsored.
Essentially, yes. They view Hatsune Miku not just as software, but as a crucial instrument of cultural soft power. The collaboration with Western artists is a deliberate bridge to overcome that 75% localization barrier.
Okay, but why Grimes? Like, if Japan wants mainstream global reach, why not pair this virtual singer with Taylor Swift or The Weeknd? Why target the alternative and hyperpop scene?
Because you need an audience that is already philosophically primed to accept a synthetic entity, Grimes is the perfect Trojan horse for this.
How so?
Well, she has over 42 million followers, and her entire artistic brand revolves around dystopian futures, artificial intelligence, and the merging of humanity and technology. Think of her album Misanthropocene.
Oh, right.
Her fans won't reject a Vocaloid. They will embrace it as high concept art.
That makes a lot of sense for Grimes, actually. But what about the younger artists on the EP? I see names like Slayer and Odatari, who blew up primarily on TikTok.
This raises an important question about generational media consumption.
Yeah.
For a Gen Z or Gen Alpha listener whose entire cultural landscape is mediated through screens, the distinction between a real influencer and a virtual avatar is increasingly irrelevant.
Really? They just don't care.
They've grown up interacting with digital entities. If the beat is catchy and the aesthetic fits their subculture, they do not care if the singer has a physical body or a pulse.
Wow, so it's conditioning the public. They're trying to legitimize a virtual performer as a genuine artist in the West, proving that you can form an authentic emotional connection with something that does not physically exist.
Exactly. And that psychological shift, accepting the virtual as equal to the tangible, is a prerequisite for the broader economic shift happening across the tech world.
Because if we can accept that a 16-year-old software program is a real pop star, it completely changes our definition of what is real.
Mm.
And that redefinition is about to hit our living rooms in a very aggressive way.
Very aggressive.
According to our stack of sources, on July 1st, Sony posted an absolute bombshell on the PlayStation blog. Starting in January 2028, they are completely ceasing physical disc production for all new games.
An entire medium is just abandoning its physical form.
They are even limiting retailers right now, only allowing them to sell one external disc drive per order. Existing discs will still work if you have the hardware. But moving forward, the future of PlayStation is entirely digital.
And naturally, the internet reacted instantly.
Oh, completely. The hashtag #SavePhysicalGames was trending within an hour. Gamers are bringing up the preservation argument, and honestly, they have a point.
They absolutely do.
Look at a game like PT, that incredible playable teaser for Silent Hills. It was a digital-only release. When the publisher decided to pull it, it just vanished from the servers.
Right. If you didn't have it downloaded, it was gone forever.
Aren't we essentially allowing corporations to burn our cultural history whenever they feel like it?
The preservation argument is robust. When you sever the physical object from the media, you leave the history of that medium entirely vulnerable to server shutdowns, expired music licenses, and corporate whims.
Yeah.
But Sony isn't making this decision based on cultural preservation. They're looking at a brutal financial equation.
Well, the newsletter points out that physical video game purchases in America dropped from over 60% in 2015 to just 18% by 2025.
Which is a massive plunge.
And Sony says 83% of PS5 sales in the first quarter of 2026 were digital. So I get that consumer habits are changing, but is that enough to totally kill physical media?
It's not just about consumer preference. It's about the mechanics of the secondary market.
Okay, explain that.
When you buy a physical game disc for $70, you play it, and then you trade it into a retailer. That retailer sells it used to someone else for $50.
Right, I used to do that all the time.
In that second transaction, the developers who made the game and Sony who hosts the platform see absolutely $0. A physical disc is a license that can be transferred infinitely without paying the creator again. Plus, physical discs mean paying manufacturing, shipping, and giving retailers a 20 to 30% cut.
Ah, so by going fully digital, they kill the used game market completely.
Exactly. When a game is tied to your specific digital account, you cannot lend it and you cannot sell it.
Wow.
If your friend wants to play it, they have to buy a brand new digital copy directly from Sony's storefront. Sony eliminates all those physical costs, takes back the retailer's cut, and forces every single player to buy a first-hand license. It is a masterclass in maximizing revenue per user.
But the psychological shift is brutal. You are no longer buying an object. You're just paying for permission to access data on someone else's server.
Games are no longer objects you own. They're licenses you access.
We are being forced into this digital-only, license-based economy. But the wild part is, the internet's actual plumbing isn't even built for us to use this economy anymore. It is being rebuilt for artificial intelligence.
Yeah, this is the invisible infrastructure layer that most people never see, but it dictates how the digital world operates.
We have a massive update here from the crypto space. On July 3rd, a major blockchain project called Moonbeam announced they are migrating away from the Polkadot ecosystem. By the end of July 2026, they're moving entirely to Base, which is backed by the crypto exchange Coinbase.
Right.
Now I'm looking at my notes here. And it says Moonbeam is pivoting from general smart contracts to becoming a settlement network specifically for AI agents.
Yes.
So what does this all mean? I need you to translate this for me because my eyes are glazing over at Ethereum Layer 2 settlement network. Break the actual mechanics of this down. Why is this move happening?
Let's strip away the jargon. Think of a Layer 1 blockchain like Polkadot or the main Ethereum network as a busy downtown city street. It's secure, but there are stoplights, traffic, and you have to pay a toll at every single intersection.
Right, like swiping my credit card to buy a coffee, it's a bit of friction.
Exactly. If a human being wants to send money once a day, the traffic is annoying, but it's manageable. But Moonbeam realizes that humans aren't the primary economic actors of the future.
Okay, so who is?
Autonomous AI agents are. Imagine an AI negotiating a micro-license to use a specific piece of data, paying Brain 0.001 cents for it, and doing that 10,000 times a minute.
Oh, wow. If that AI is stuck in the downtown traffic of a Layer 1 blockchain, paying a toll for every single microtransaction, the business model collapses instantly. The toll booth is just too slow and expensive for robots to use.
Which is exactly why they're moving to Base, an Ethereum Layer 2. A Layer 2 is essentially a private, high-speed subway line built underneath that crowded city street.
I see.
It bundles thousands of these microtransactions together at lightning speed, processing them in about 2 seconds for a fraction of a penny, and then periodically drops a receipt off up on the main street for security.
Okay, so what does this all mean for the broader tech landscape?
It means the financial rails are being laid down for non-human commerce. Traditional credit card networks process things in batches, and they charge merchant fees of around 2-3%.
Right.
That system is fundamentally incompatible with an AI streaming fractions of a cent continuously. The market understood this pivot immediately. Moonbeam's GLMR token jumped 31% in 24 hours, from 18 cents to over 23 cents.
That's a huge jump.
Yeah. By aligning with Base, which has Coinbase's backing, they secure the liquidity and the speed necessary for this new AI-to-AI economy.
It is slightly terrifying that AI agents are getting this frictionless, high-speed financial highway, while human beings are still stuck out here trying to figure out how to afford access to all these new AI tools without emptying our bank account.
Which brings us to our final source, and it perfectly illustrates how companies are exploiting the human desire to secure a permanent stake in this shifting digital landscape.
Yeah, on July 4th, a viral deal started making the rounds for a platform called Chat Playground AI. This site acts as an aggregator. So instead of having a tab open for ChatGPT and another for Claude and another for Gemini, they put over top-tier models into one single interface.
It's an incredibly appealing proposition for a consumer tired of subscription fatigue.
Right. They've got GPT-4o, Claude Sonnet 4, Gemini 1.5 Flash, DeepSeek V3, Llama, and more. And the hook was unbelievable. They offered a lifetime unlimited plan for just $55.30 using the promo code JULY30.
And the regular price was allegedly over $600, a 91% discount.
I looked at this and every alarm bell in my head went off. I mean, how can you possibly offer lifetime access for $55 when you have to pay companies like Anthropic and OpenAI every single time I send a prompt?
Right.
If I use the service heavily for a month, I will cost them more than that in back-end fees alone. It sounds like a trap.
Right.
What is the actual mechanism making this work?
If we connect this to the bigger picture, you are looking at a classic digital arbitrage play. Chat Playground is essentially a middleman. Think of an API fee, like a taxi meter, that runs every time data is requested.
Okay.
Chat Playground negotiates wholesale bulk access to these AI models, getting a significantly lower rate on that meter than you could as an individual.
But they are still paying the meter. So why only charge me $55 once?
Because in the short term, cash flow is more valuable than long-term margins. By advertising a massive 91% discount on a lifetime plan, they create intense FOMO, fear of missing out.
Oh, for sure. Thousands of people probably drop $55 on a holiday weekend.
Exactly. Chat Playground instantly secures a massive war chest of capital. They front load their revenue.
Okay, I follow the cash grab. But eventually, my daily usage of the AI will outpace the $55 I gave them. The math has to break eventually. Mm-hmm. What happens when I become an unprofitable user?
That is where the legal definition of lifetime comes into play, and it echoes exactly what we saw with Sony.
I mean,
lifetime does not refer to your human lifespan. It refers to the lifespan of the corporate entity offering the deal, or more specifically, as long as they decide to honor it.
Wait, can they just change the deal after I pay?
If you read the terms of service, they explicitly reserve the right to throttle your request speeds, cap your daily limits, or remove premium models from your access tier entirely without notice. The word unlimited is doing an incredible amount of heavy lifting, supported entirely by legal asterisks.
Wow. So we are back exactly where we started with physical games. You think you are locking down permanence. You think a one-time payment buys you an asset you can rely on forever.
But in reality, you don't actually own anything forever.
Right. You don't own the AI access, just like you don't own the digital PlayStation game. You are simply holding a temporary license that a corporation can and will revoke the second the math stops working in their favor.
We are systematically trading permanent ownership for temporary convenience across every single sector of entertainment and technology.
And that ties this entire stack of sources together perfectly. We started with Google trying to rewrite historical independence as a digital group project. And we end with the stark realization that our own digital independence is an illusion.
It really is.
We are navigating an era where our pop stars are synthetic algorithms, our creative history is tangled in AI copyright discovery, the internet's financial plumbing is being optimized for robots instead of humans, and our ownership of games and software is entirely conditional. It is a massive paradigm shift. Thank you so much to you listening for coming along on this deep dive with us today.
It is a lot to synthesize, but understanding the underlying mechanisms of these changes is really the only way to adapt. And looking at all of this together leaves me with one final question to consider. We are moving into a world where digital games can be deleted from a server overnight, where lifetime AI access can be throttled on a whim, and where media is effortlessly generated by algorithms. In that world, will verifiable physical authenticity become the ultimate luxury status symbol of the 2030s? Will we eventually pay a massive premium just to prove a human made something or to own a physical object that no tech company can remotely delete?
That is a brilliant thought to leave off on. In an endlessly synthetic world, the most rebellious thing you can own might just be something real. Thank you all for listening, and we'll catch you on the next deep dive.